Hello and welcome to Cavaliers Break Bad, the Breaking Bad podcast, one of many. All right, to start off, before we jump into season two, part one, that's episode 1-7, we spoil everything. The idea is that this is a retrospective, so we kind of take into account things that happen in season 3, 4, 5, everything up to season 5, episode 8, because the final 8 haven't aired yet. We will be having a look at those when they air in a couple of days, so we better hurry up or we're going to run out of time, and Breaking Bad will end without us. So,
and that would be a tragedy.
Yes.
For the entire world.
So yeah. Where were we?
Well, I assume we were at the end of season one. Now we're up to the beginning of season two.
Yes. Do you want to do a previously on Breaking Bad?
Previously on Cavaliers Break Bad.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we kind of just wrapped up what we kind of saw to be the basic kind of themes of season one and, looking at moral dislocation and whatnot, kind of looking at the trajectories for the characters.
Yeah. Whatnot. Well, anyway, like, where we left off, so season one ends with, basically that scene where they make their deal with Tuco. Tuco says that they're going to make a lot of money together, and then he beats the shit out of one of his henchmen. And we start season two
with the first line that that henchman says in the entire show.
Yes.
Which is a lovely touch.
And we start off with there's actually overlap. They actually start with the end of season one, that you actually see the same scene twice, and then it's extended.
Into the beginning of season two, when he says, "Hey Heisenberg, you're good at science. Fix him." When he's bleeding from every part of his
every
face.
Orifice. He's got Tuco-induced Ebola.
So yeah, what's the cold open of this one? The cold open of this episode is the. Are you sure? Isn't it the eye?
Oh, no,
it's the
course.
Eye in the bear. Of
yeah,
course.
Fuck it's it. It's the bear. Right. Yeah. So, season two, of course, is based around the, yeah, sorry, we've got jelly snakes here and, you know.
Yeah.
You can't.
The good thing.
There's no rest for jelly snakes. Yeah, well, season two, of course, centers around the bear in the swimming pool, the pink bear with half its face missing. Could that be foreshadowing to a certain character?
Oh, mate, we'll
knows?
Get into that. We will get into that.
But apart from that quite distant foreshadowing, there's just the fact that obviously this is leading to something, and seeing as you've seen the show, as we warned you earlier, you'll know, of course, that Walt will cause a plane crash by the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
And now, it's pretty common knowledge that
It will cause a plane crash, yes. And that's.
And you could say that the plane crash is an effect.
I'd go as far as saying yes.
Yeah.
That is exactly what it is.
But speaking of those cold opens and the bear, the bear appears in four episodes.
In this first part of season two, or all up?
In all up.
Right.
737,
yep.
Down, over. And ABQ.
Yes.
Now, if you didn't know this already, because it is known, but Christian didn't know it, so I'll just have to catch up on him. They spell out basically what happens at the end of the season. 737 down over ABQ when Walt makes the plane crash. But anyway, getting back to the actual part of the episode, which is Tuco beats the shit out of... And already I get the sense that, like, season two, it just from the get-go just feels a bit darker. What do you think?
Yeah. I feel it's also clearer just in the tone that they're kind of going for and the ideas that they've kind of narrowed them down. Because as we were talking about with season one, the crash hadn't happened by that point, but it had by the time season two rolled around.
Yeah.
So it had kind of become, you know, clearly that kind of climate had changed. And we get the setups for two things that I kind of find very interesting details in the show. We've got the introduction of Ryson. Introduction of Ryson, which is obviously a massive, massive thing in the entire Breaking Bad landscape. But we will go into, I hope, great detail on that over time. But there is the first sight of Ted Beneke in a photo with Skyler. As well.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
There's the introduction of that character, which obviously goes into financial crime quite clearly throughout his involvement with the show.
So. Yeah, also the thing about season two is it's the only season that they ever wrote from start to finish pretty much in one go. I mean, not the actual scripts, of course, but every single episode was planned out from the get-go, and they knew exactly where they were going. So that's why you can get the kind of intricate flash forwards to the plane crash. So yeah, like that's a good example of already they're kind of setting things up, like Ted Beneke that will become more important later. And I don't even think to my memory, we don't get a lot of resolution about Beneke this season. It's kind of...
It's a lot further along the line.
Yeah, but it's an interesting thing they set up. But yeah, I just think that there's a darker tone. For instance, like already Hank is kind of more sympathetic from absolutely. The get-go. Like, it's like you can tell that in the break between season one and two, they've just got... The writers have gone, you know, we should give Hank more depth, and they know they've got this PTSD plotline coming up with him and Tuco and going to El Paso, so already they're making him more likable
yes,
and more relatable.
Yes, he's kind of rounded more as a character, because, like, obviously in that first season, he's kind of speaking in either baseball or poker metaphors. But still, he is, like, in this episode, he gets a photo with Gonzo's corpse laughing his head off, and that was pretty fucked.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you're not like, oh, well, he's a relatable guy now. You're still like, I mean, the way that is communicated, that he is a rounded, kind of interesting, complex character, is through the darkness that you are kind of talking
and
about.
And I think, though, that points to what they're kind of doing with Hank this season, is that kind of really flippant attitude towards sort of the violence is a front, which of course is
yeah,
sort of cliche,
absolutely.
But like
which kind of gets developed more in the Tortuga incident in Nigroy Azul,
and of course the Tuco shootout.
Yeah.
Another thing about this episode, it was also directed by Bryan Cranston, his first directing job.
Yes.
And yeah, he's pretty good director.
There are some really nice transitions in it.
Yeah, that's true.
Very nicely considered. The one. Also, he needs $737,000.
Yeah.
And the 737 goes down, which is I only realized that a couple of days ago. I still don't know what to make of it. I enjoy that. I enjoy it.
Yeah, well, it's just a way to get the episode title in there. But yeah, no, it's actually an elegant solution because they have to make these words all have double meanings for each of the episode titles. And it's pretty easy to do with down and over. And because ABQ is actually about the plane crash, they can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
But with this one, they have to come up with like a reason to get this pretty specific number. So they reverse engineer all these maths so that Walt has to get $737,000
to support his family once he's gone.
Yeah, but just in terms of the darkness and how it's already... Even though there's, like, a real strong sense of continuity because it literally picks up... It doesn't even pick up. Like, it goes back a bit and then continues, fleshes that scene out. Because, like, season one, of course, you have this whole thing about Walt's sex drive coming back now that he's dealing drugs. And in this episode, he tries to kind of assert that again, and he essentially tries to rape Skylar.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the violence, so that's like how the sex is kind of what's changed between the seasons. And then the violence, you know, you've got... At the end of the first season, you have that bit with Tuco beating the shit, and it's intense, and it's heavy, and it's dark, but, you know, there is kind of this dark comedy moment to it, particularly, like, look at this!
Yeah, yeah, and that moment, obviously, where he's saying, see the damage almost that you're doing.
Yeah. But that's kind of like a black comedy moment. And then in this, you know, you get the immediate aftermath of that, which is this guy has, like, I forget exactly what Walt calls it, but he has some kind of stroke, which is kind of much more heavy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, just a bit. So, yeah, no, I think absolutely there is a... I mean, I don't think I got it the first time through necessarily, but there is a real kind of... Not levity, but real kind of humorous edge to a lot of things that happen in the first season, which almost doesn't come back to that degree until somebody like Saul comes along. But just in terms of the actual situations kind of suggesting themselves with comedy, it doesn't really come back until something like... The Madrigal situation in season 5, which is just absolutely hilarious, that cold open with Madrigal.
Yeah.
Testing the sources.
I mean, Breaking Bad gets kind of less funny as it goes on because it just gets darker, but I don't think it ever loses its sense of humor. It's just kind of.
Oh,
like,
yeah, no.
Like, we still have Huel.
Yeah, oh, yeah, no, absolutely. On this one, Marie's kleptomania is a really kind of it's an odd element to look back on. I think
they really paid off Marie's kleptomania in the episode Open House in season 4, which obviously we'll talk about later, but that kind of tied it in with Hank, and I feel like we kind of got a solid interesting and kind of nice sense of closure in regards to their relationship.
Yeah.
Not that that's, like, exactly what I was dying for, but, I mean, if you kind of create these characters, you've got to do something with them. And yeah. I feel like they kind of brought it all together in an elegant way down the track. But, yeah, I know what you mean. In this yeah. episode, you're kind of like, why?
At this point, you're like, yeah, what thematic relevance does this have to everything else? Like, even just as a character decision?
Well,
like, what, like, you know, somebody who's already quite entitled or you know, is doing quite well for themselves, is kind of taking stuff that they don't necessarily deserve or earned or isn't theirs to take, maybe.
Well, no,
that,
I mean,
that's like an element to it, but still, even then, it kind of just feels like a bit of a... just does feel like a bit of a thematic loose end. And you do kind of find yourself relieved when it kind of goes away from it in later episodes.
I don't think it's a thematic loose end. I think it's more of a narrative loose end. I think it's both.
So,
well, yeah. I think thematically it's quite sound. It was the kleptomania is, you know, it's not about the gain, it's about the act. And that's really what the path that Walt has gone on. It's actually, we know really it's not about the money anymore, even though he's kind of puts this arbitrary sum of $737,000. We know from his interaction with Gretchen that he is not just in it for the money, he's in it to break bad. And that kind of on a much smaller level is what Marie is doing. And by drawing that kind of
in a different way though, because...
Well, exactly, that's the point.
There's a whole kind of like with... And we'll get to it with... the whole H. Tracy Hall situation with Walter and everything. So there's a very different thing. So tying it, that's the thing, is it just feels a little bit flimsy tying the kleptomania to it. Because, I mean, it is effective enough on its own to, you know, kind of...
Sure. I don't think the kleptomania subplot was great, but I think if, you know, between Marie's kleptomania and Skylar's embezzlement later on, or her assistance, you kind of get... This nice little, you know, there are lots of ways to break bad. Yeah. And I know, it's not...
Without it being like a deliberate, calculated kind of thing, something you just fall into in a way, which doesn't make it any less bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's not... Yeah, I agree. When they do the kleptomania subplot in this episode, does feel a bit half-baked. But you do... It is also important because it sets up Hank as more of a relatable protagonist.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. And also you really start to get the distance in this episode between Skylar and Walt more, I feel.
Yeah.
It becomes more of a kind of toxic home situation. I think that is kind of why it almost feels darker, is it's like the house is no longer... sort of the classic...
The home?
It's not the home. Yeah. It's, like, really sort of toxic and hostile, and Walt's kind of constantly dodging or afraid in there. And then, of course, at the end, you know... And the home... Actually, what's great is they kind of break the first rule that they've established in the show, is that at the end of the episode, you know, the home's safe. When Walt's at home, kind of nothing can go wrong. And then he goes outside and Tuco's there.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. So I guess that leads us into episode two.
Just quickly though, episode one, we've got another setup, which is Jesse's gun, which is just a fun thing to keep an eye on. He buys a gun.
Oh yeah, he buys a gun. Right. Yeah.
And basically that makes its way through two sets of hands, but it kind of goes back and forth for a little while.
Yeah, it goes up to episode six. That one.
Yes, but you know.
Anyway, so
We'll just track it as it goes. So we've got an eye on Jesse's gun.
Yeah, and Walt, of course, in this episode takes Jesse's gun and then forgets to bring it when...
Yeah.
Tuco
arrives.
Comes knocking.
Yeah. So onto episode two, Grilled.
Yeah, Grilled.
Mastress penned and directed by Charles Hayde, an actor from Hill Street Blues.
Very interesting.
Yeah, some old fart actor. So, yeah, cold open is Jesse's Lowrider, one of my favourite, definitely one of my favourite for this season, just because it could be absolutely anything. You've got absolutely no idea what's going on, and I love that in the cold open, because it just kind of stops you and just brings you into some kind of confusion, but intense engagement.
It's a classic Breaking Bad cold open, where it's just kind of, it's the flash forward, it's ominous, you know, something's happened, you don't know exactly what, and the closer you get to that moment, the more you realise what's going to happen, but it's still until the very end that it kind of clicks. Sort of and like it, Crazy Handful of Nothing, even though that's quite clear that...
It's kind of like the piece of the jigsaw that on its own makes absolutely no sense, but gradually as you surround it with story and give it some context, you're like, oh.
Mm.
Of course. And I really like it Like the ones that are like that with no humans or at least no faces.
Exactly. But it's also really important for preserving the suspense because, you know, Jesse's, as the episode progresses, you're like, oh, well, you know, Jesse could be dead.
Yeah.
Or, and then as it keeps going on, you know, Hank could be dead. So yeah, I agree. Like, you know, something's gone down. You don't know who's won, who's lost, who's escaped, as it goes on. But yeah, also what I like about this episode is, so half of it is them on near the border, around the border with Tuco and Tio. And the other half is Hank's investigation into Walt. And I feel like this is kind of where the plots start to intersect really well between Hank's investigation and Heisenberg. Like, it kind of felt like it was just sort of a little background noise. They didn't know where they were going for. But I feel like the momentum starts to build at this point. And the way that kind of Skyler looking for Walt and Hank looking for Walt, but Hank also looking for Heisenberg and Tuco and Jesse, and it kind of the way it all intersects without anyone finding out, but also without it feeling contrived and in that patented kind of, Dexter sort of way.
It's kind of classic detective fiction that, like, he's looking for four things at once, but they're all the same thing.
Yeah, but, you know, he only finds one of them or something. Yeah, of course. It's really
and
well.
And then gradually, like, that's the thing about this, is gradually rather than all at once, he realizes that they all tie up. So yeah, but so there are a lot of really incredible kind of moments in this. The tension of this episode is quite unlike anything up to this point, and maybe not matched until it was surpassed by Box Cutter, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of kind of the way that it happens in real time, and you feel a real danger about everything that's kind of going on.
Yeah, so the tension in this scene is when Walt and Jesse are trapped in Tuco's... I don't know what
it's his outhouse. It's the place where he waits for his cousins to come get him.
Yeah.
Also his cousins, which we assume are the Salamanca brothers,
who we will meet in the start of season three. Yeah, it's the first scene of season three is them.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But the tension of just, so it's where they've tried to poison Tuco, and Tio's trying to warn Tuco, and the tension in that scene is so unbearable.
Mark Margolis,
who's in Oz and Pie.
And he's a brilliant character.
Yeah, he's a really good actor. But in this, he just kind of gets to look like he's had a stroke and ring a bell. But he still got an Emmy nomination for it.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
good.
Not this season, in season four.
Oh,
where he gets to do a bit more expressive.
I wish we could. I was just podcast. Twitching my face quite hard there.
Yeah, if we could podcast faces. So the tension in that scene, I mean, it's been said so many times, it's really unbearable. And I remember when we were watching it together, we were like, oh, yeah, I don't know if this episode is really going to... Because we know what happens, you know, there's no tension. We just go,
No, it's still so intense. It's so good.
Particularly when my favourite bit in this episode, my favourite bit of comedy is when, you know, did they do something to you, Tio? And then Walt goes... Yes, I changed the channel. I changed his show. Yeah, you know, he was watching those telenovelas. I told you not to change it, Mr. White. and you know, Tuco's kind of out of it enough to sort of believe their bullshit, but he's still like, I'm going to kill you.
I also love, like, he cooks up some decent grub.
Oh, I know, he feeds his hostage as well.
I know, it's really
that looks tasty.
Like, and, you know, just even the offer's like, we're going to go cook in Mexico. He's just like, cannot tell you how unappealing that sounds, mate. That's crap.
He's amazing. He thinks he's being completely benign to
Walt.
I know,
exactly.
Not to Jesse.
Yeah, no.
Yeah,
but I love also there are some really nice Jesse Walt moments in this as well, because Jesse says, like, I thought because you'd be dying soon, you just want to go and, like, sacrifice yourself. And you just, like, so Jesse kind of assumes Walt's martyrdom is a complete no-brainer.
Yeah.
Just, like, instantly. So I think that's a really funny little kind of character moment there.
Also, we get the setup here for the fact that when pushed... I don't know if this still holds true. It's held true for a while in 3 and 4. That when pushed, Walt will... not necessarily in his best interest, try and protect Jesse. Because this becomes a massive plot point in season 3 and 4, all the, you know, even though he does it in the stupidest way later on. But yeah, you get, it's kind of the first signs. He's the way he kind of says, you know, to Tuco, you can't take me if you kill Jesse, is very similar to how he eventually falls out with Gus. Although with Gus, it's a lot more his fault, essentially. Yeah. Whereas Tuco, you just kind of gotta improvise. Whereas you can avoid pissing off Gus.
Also, in this one, we've got the first instance of Jesse shooting anybody. He shoots Tuco in the gut. And then really enjoys not being at the end of Tuco's gun afterwards.
I just love also that, you know, they shoot Tuco and then Walt says, let him bleed. And no one, not me, I'm pretty sure not you, no one goes, like, thinks about the morality of that. Everyone's like, yep, you deserved it. I'd do the same thing. Fuck him.
It's just like, he's like the you know, the Mexican Tommy DeVito, really.
Yeah. just kill him. We don't give a shit.
Yeah. But also, Hector in this, I think there's not quite
Hector
any
Salamanca.
Hector Salamanca.
Tio Hector Salamanca.
There is not quite any character I've seen who can just, because he doesn't say anything ever. Well, he does in a flashback, a 12-minute long flashback in season 4.
Yeah, he gets to be Mark Margolis in his kingpin self.
I mean, he nails it, but like,
yeah,
that just, the tension around him and his dinger. Which becomes, I mean, you know, what else?
Well, we open the show with the dinger.
Yeah. Oh, and that really nice moment where the diegetic sound of the ding at the end becomes
the
non-diegetic
theme tune. Yeah, our Dave
music,
Porter,
which is really nice.
The composer for the show remixed. He remixes the theme pretty much every week, unless there's some other piece of music. And
like Jesse's Twat Hammer.
Yeah, which is great. But for this episode, the episode ends with a ding, and then he does this remix with the bell sound and a violin version of the theme, which you've just heard at the start of this episode, and it's really cool. One of the reasons, because of course you don't get that on TV, because they push it out for, you know, next time and Breaking Bad, and stick around on AMC.com. You don't get that, but if you have it on DVD, if you bought it legally, kids, then you get the nice opening, you get the closing credits.
So, yeah. Oh, also, just one thing I'd like to mention about this episode. It's my first moment that I just realised I just straight up thought was shit. When Tuco opens the boot and Walt's looking out and it's like this Skylar, like with a Vaseline lens and completely backlit like an angel. So he's like, Walt, I'm here. And you're just like, well, yeah, that's the first sign that it was directed by a 70-year-old, that he thinks that's okay. But apart from that, the classical filmmaking and, you know, the obvious care for craft kind of carries it through, particularly with like certain kind of Hitchcocky moments.
And it's appropriate for the material. Yeah, but I also, that's just weird. That whole thing with Skylar sort of appearing in the vision, I don't get why that was put there. I mean, his relationship with Skylar at this stage is kind of so, at such a weird point, it sort of feels weird.
I know, and also the fact that it was Mastris who wrote this episode. I mean, this is like something that I'm surprised got past the writer's room at all, to be perfectly honest. Like, it's just a weird moment. You're not like, oh, that's beautiful. Oh, Tuco, he's crazy. No, it's just like, what the fuck?
I guess from a character standpoint, you could argue that the kind of the interesting thing about that is that Walt is sort of so hostile. Not hostile, he just kind of, whenever he's with Skylar, he doesn't care, but sort of as an ideal, as the ends to this ridiculous escapade, he kind of cares for her, but he doesn't actually care for her as a person anymore. But I don't know, I found it weird as well.
So we've got a tally, we've got one moment that we thought was the bad side of 50%. Good.
Yeah. And then, so this episode ends with Hank shooting Tuco, and the lowrider bumps up and down, and Walt and Jesse make a run for it. And that leads us into episode 203, which is Bitten by a Dead Bee.
Yep. Bit by a Dead Bee.
Bit by a Dead Bee. Sorry, not bitten. what was I thinking? Also,
Peter Gould.
Yeah, going back, the episode title of episode two is called Grilled. And there was this talk about, there's this great little, they have an episode title explanation in the new Breaking Bad book, Alchemy, which is like this iPad book. It's kind of cute. It's like a coffee table book that is digital. Anyway, like they were explaining that episode title, and it's like,
Tuco's Grills?
Well, yeah, it's his grills. Yeah. It's the fact that they're grill, like they're under pressure, and the fact that he grills them.
He grills me.
And I just thought, that's kind of really lame, but it's so brilliant. Lame, but
really nice. Yeah.
So anyway, Bit by a Dead Bee starts off with, you know, him hitchhiking.
And then being butt naked in the supermarket,
which is a great cold open. And also, apparently, Bryan Cranston has a reputation as he will get naked at a drop of a hat. He does not have any qualms with dropping his gear.
Oh, and for some, though, I just realised he's not completely naked. He's got his Heisenberg hat on.
Does he keep the Heisenberg hat on?
Yeah.
Really?
He keeps the Heisenberg hat on.
Oh.
Wait. No, that's later. That's later when he does the callback when he's in his room and he puts the hat on and he says, "Darling, I'm just popping out to 7-Eleven. Do you want anything?"
Oh.
It's a really kind of nice, weird little moment where he kind of like makes light of it and Skylar's still...
That's weird because I always thought that there was a whole thing about the Heisenberg hat never appeared in the house or outside of the drug dealing life until season 5 when he takes it out of the car.
That moment in the, at the end of this episode where he puts it on and...
Well, I'm just going to say that's non-canon. Because they were keeping it really good up, you know. They probably didn't realise how important the hat would become. Because afterwards they make more of a very, like, concerted effort to keep the two separate.
And it looks ridiculous. Like...
The hat.
The pork pie hat.
It looked ridiculous, but now we have connotations of Heisenberg. Yeah, exactly. It looks
It's terrifying.
Terrifying.
And the moustache and the glasses.
Yeah, I mean, well, the moustache never looked good.
It's a package.
The moustache never looked good. The beard. The Heisenberg beard looks fearsome, but the moustache never looked good. I think Bryan Cranston described his moustache in the first two seasons as a limp caterpillar. But yeah, so
absolutely.
Now we were in this episode. He's in the doctor's office, or the therapist's office, and he's looking at the painting on the wall. Yeah. Now
we notice this. We think
that comes. Well, look, I know
think,
that there's
we think a... it's a setup. Well, not a setup. It's a thematic point right now, but we noticed. In season 5, there's potentially a callback to it
is definitely a callback. I know for a fact that in Gliding Overall, the painting is
a direct callback.
Is a direct callback. However, I'm not entirely sure if it's this painting.
Right.
I assume it
well,
is.
Well, the point is that it feels...
Yeah.
It feels like it is.
Anyway.
And it's just interesting to kind of see that same kind of image... From two very different perspectives, like Heisenberg looking at it then, and Walt looking at it in season 2, and Heisenberg looking at it in season 5, when he's about to become the mass murderer that he
when he's with the Nazis. and that's when Nazis.
Yeah.
Yes, but then a lot of this episode is taken up with Walt talking to the therapist and kind of. It's sort of, there's this pretty important character moment where he kind of explains why his life's so crap. And once again, it reminds you why he broke, because as we were saying in the first season, you know, Walt's so pathetic at the start of the show that you kind of want the inner Heisenberg to come out until the inner Heisenberg actually does come out. But in this episode, he kind of reminds the therapist and the audience why his life's so crap is that he's dying, you know, his wife's pregnant.
Yeah, he says, like, why did you run? And then he kind of explains it. He says, you know.
Yeah. And also, that's kind of the flip side of that is when, I forget the exact episode, but might be this episode, is that Hank talks to Skylar about Marie and if she could offer support, and Skylar says, I'm pregnant, my husband's got cancer, I don't know where he goes at night. And my spoilt bitch sister is not the one that needs support right now. So it's kind of nice, those two monologues each remind everyone that the White household is crap, except for Junior, who, you know, has his breakfast. Except they didn't get Raisin Bran. And then we have Jesse trying to outsmart the DEA with Wendy.
Oh, yes. Brilliant. Waffle House. Waffle House is good.
Yes. He goes to the Waffle House afterwards, after Walt's Waffles. No. Walt's Waffles.
Walt's Waffles. That's next episode. Don't let's get out of
ourselves. Okay. All right. Christian has a nice point on Walt's Waffles.
Yeah.
And also, it's interesting. You get the... You kind of, this episode, after we sort of made Hank more likable in the first two episodes, you now realize that he's not just likable, but also he's complex, because clearly the whole shooting Tuco wasn't as much of a great victory for him as it sort of seemed to be. And there's this sense that he's really kind of taking it a bit hard. And
yeah,
I don't think it's this episode.
It isn't this episode. It's episode 5. It's Breakage.
Yeah, where Hank has kind of a panic attack in the elevator. Yeah, right.
And I've got something to say about that. Okay. Well. So let's charge through episode 3. So Hector's chair shit is a very, very interesting moment, because it also kind of sets up
just Hector comes into the
DEA when they've got Jesse in there, and they ask him to identify Jesse, to identify whether or not he was at the house. And of course, this is a very tense moment for Jesse. But Hector just shits in his chair instead of answering a very simple question. And you think, oh, come on, like, he'd have to really hate the feds. Which is actually just a nice setup. Like, yeah, this is how much this dude hates the feds.
What feels like a plot, just a convenience comes...
Actually becomes a very massive character point. It's
extremely important for the end of season 4. His lack of... You know, his unwillingness to talk to the DEA.
He can tell them who Gus Fring is, but instead he chooses to blow him up and make him a half man.
We said there'd be spoilers.
Yeah.
But Gus isn't even here yet. So just the last thing I want to talk about in this episode is there's a moment where Walt sneaks home to take care of the gun and the money. Now, we still couldn't work out why Walt moved the fucking gun and the money. Because in the previous episode, he takes the money and the gun and puts it from the air vent into a diaper box. I don't know why he did that.
And just left it there and then walked out. And then he comes back in. And then doesn't he just put it straight back?
Yeah, he puts it straight back.
Yeah.
So I really don't understand what the point was there. I don't know. Maybe we're missing something. I feel like we are, because I don't think they put it there for no reason.
There's a really nice, there's actually quite a nice, the way that they cover, like, the consolidation, like, at the end, when they get on the phone to each other after Walt's out of hospital and Jesse's at home and everything. It's just really nicely shot, and there's a lot of movement in it, but they kind of keep the right side of the line, so it actually feels like a conversation, really nicely kind of balanced. And also the lighting difference.
Conversation at the end, the camera quite is moving.
Really quite fluid.
So. Yeah, but actually keeps it quite stable and you're orientated well. Yeah, that's a really nice piece of directing there.
There's also, after that, when Walt goes home and then comes back, after seeing, like, a moment between Junior and Skylar.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah. That's really important.
It's a really... That moment itself of just seeing Junior and Skylar completely on their own. He feels completely isolated from that as well. And then he goes back to the bus shelter and sees a missing sign. He sees the missing sign that they put up with his face on it. And it's just like, in more ways than one.
Yeah. But also it demonstrates how Walt is not necessarily the good guy. Mm. He also, I think it's the first moment of realization that he, like, his family would in many ways be better off without him, with just the memory of the good Walter more than anything. And what's also the thing is, in Fly, he talks about the perfect moment to die. And you feel like this is the beginning of that thought process, when he feels like he kind of could leave them behind. So episode 4, which is Down, is the second of the Pink Bear quadrilogy. Which sounds with like the title for the worst box set ever. The Pink Bear,
Bear Quadrilogy.
Yeah, well, remember
I wouldn't buy that.
There was the Alien infamously titled Quadrilogy. So, yeah, I think we should have the Pink Bear Quadrilogy. Anyway,
that would sell well.
Yeah. And we get a bit more revealed with the hazmat suits and sort
and
of
Walt's glasses
and Walt's glasses.
In the evidence bag.
Yeah. What when you first saw this, do you remember? Because I can't. Yeah, do you remember what you thought?
I was kind of thinking like, so they had to end up cooking at the house, and there was some explosion or something went wrong, and there's, you know, as a result, like people come into the house, and then of course that kind of gets subverted. You kind of assume, because it's so local, like to the pool, you assume even just something happened in the backyard. And then when you've got like more personal effects, you think, oh, something happened in the house and they're just collecting in the backyard. And then later you see just all these like streets of just hazmat suits, and you're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You almost think, I think, and also maybe it's like a post 9/11 kind of thing, and just that whole kind of fear surrounding that just age that we are still pretty much in, particularly in American media, a lot is based still on the fear of terrorism.
No, age is over.
Well, okay, fine, whatever. But that is a present thought as well. So, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I don't think so. But yeah, I think I'm pretty sure, I can't remember why. I think I thought it was a lab explosion. I think everyone thought it was going to be a lab explosion, because that just made the most sense.
Yeah.
But anyway, this episode basically is Walt trying to make amends and Jesse's life falling apart. And really badly. And I think this episode is kind of like the flip side of, or not the flip side, just like sort of a reminiscent of Cancer Man or Grey Matter from last episode, which is the character.
Last season.
Last season. What did I say?
Episode.
Right. So it's basically, after this big event that the season is opened with, we split Walt and Jesse apart, and then they have to kind of face crises in their personal life, which will ultimately push them back to cooking meth.
Yep.
And this has a fantastically pathetic performance from Bryan Cranston with his
Walt's waffle.
And
it's just on Steely Dan. I couldn't help but notice that, because I love it, and it's a band that my dad has instilled a great love for them in me, because that's what dads do. They talk about Steely Dan.
Yeah.
And it's almost like his attempt to kind of just be a dad.
Yeah.
Like, still, in terms of sheer musicianship, they are unmatched.
It's such a good dad band to choose, because it's not something really obviously daggy, like Huey Lewis and the News or something.
Or like
but
America or Crosby, Stills,
and Nash. But it's like something kind of good enough but still daggy.
Yeah.
I found that bit hilarious. And Skylar's just having none of that. And it's just kind of that, it's just so sad on Walt's part. You know, this kind of, he knows Skylar's not having any of it, yet he persists. And he persists in his daggy ways. And the cell phone lie. Well, I don't even remember what it is, because it's so fucking convoluted what he cooks up. But it's something about he changed providers and got a new phone. And Skylar just immediately sees how much crap he's talking.
I mean, that does get a bit tired. The whole, Walt's lying to Skylar and Skylar's not buying it. No. And, like, he finally calms it over to a point, and then, of course, he says, like, what phone?
Oh, yeah, at the end of the season. It's sort of,
brilliant.
So, the second cell phone is kind of like a little Chekhov's gun of this season. Yeah. It's the key to Skylar knowing or not knowing. Mm. But
we've also got the Flynn, the first time Walt Jr. calls himself Flynn.
Oh, so this is the first appearance of Flynn? What? Oh, yeah, no, starts calling him.
Mm.
We'll have to take note of when he becomes Walt Jr. again.
So, Ep 4, Season 2, Flynn for the first time.
Okay, Flynn, we'll see. We'll do a count on how long it takes for him to get back. The other one is Jesse. Last episode, he gets the RV towed into that kind of dodgy guy who, like, Badger's cousin or something. Then he gets kicked out of his house. The house is cleared of all belongings. Then he breaks into the RV, falls into the toilet, gets covered in that blue shit, which I don't even want to know what that is. It's apparently bad enough that when he goes into the RV, he has to sleep with a gas mask on. And then cry himself to sleep.
So, yeah.
And then he's woken up by the owner with a shotgun. Is it with a shotgun or a dog or
I'm pretty sure it's a shotgun.
Yeah.
So you know, it's really just kind of pathetic moment for Jesse, and it's kind of interesting because he comes straight from his mum saying, "Whatever you do, son, turn your life around." And you know, it's kind of that kind of whole American idea of like, "Don't be a loser, be a winner." And I mean, with Jesse, we all see how well that turns out. So, you know.
Well, he does, of course, because, like, he takes their advice and buys the house out from under them.
He does well. He doesn't do good.
No, exactly. That's the thing. Because of the two. And, I mean, it's kind of like the same with Cancer Man and from last season where Jesse tried, or maybe that's Grey Matter, one of the two, kind of that two-episode arc, where Jesse tries to get a legit job and how he can't. He's just kind of stuck in this inert state of sort of being with people like Badger and Skinny Pete and Walt.
And Combo. Don't forget Combo. Still around.
Yeah, Combo. I'm going to miss Combo. I forgot how great...
I love Combo.
Combo's great. Combo, you really get the sense that Combo is smarter than Badger and Skinny Pete.
No.
Yeah.
I don't. At all.
Badger is the dumbest.
Badger is the dumbest, but Skinny Pete's also... The point of them is that they are retards. It's kind of like getting three village idiots from three different villages and saying, well, which one's the village idiot of that village? You know, it's impossible.
Yeah. Well, look, anyway, I...
Sorry, these jelly snacks are distracting me. They're great.
Interesting thing about Jesse's arc in this episode is my dad's partner, because my dad is also a big fan of Breaking Bad, and he also, if he grew a beard, could look a lot like Walt. So I'm trying to convince him.
My dad too.
Yeah, I know.
And he's also a
Your dad kind of looks like Walt at the start of the series. My dad kind of looks like Heisenberg. Sorry, let's be honest.
I'm happy to not have Heisenberg particularly close to me.
Anyway.
of course, not cool.
But anyway, my dad's girlfriend was... he tried to introduce her to Breaking Bad, and this was the first episode she saw. And she couldn't watch it, because she just thought that Jesse's arc in this episode was so bleak and horrible. Even though it is kind of funny, it was just so fucked up. And I guess you're sort of used to bad shit. But it really is just, as TV tropes would say, the humiliation conga.
Yeah, and I mean, it's one of those things, though, for both of them in a way, but on different ends of the spectrum, because, you know, Jesse gets abandoned by his parents and Walt kind of gets abandoned by
his family.
His son, particularly, I mean, because Skylar's still there just doing her passive-aggressive thing. Mm. And Walt Jr. is actually kind of, he's changing his name to Flynn. Like, they try to go driving in a car park, which may or may not be the one in which he blows up his car later.
Yeah.
But he's just kind of, you really get the kind of sense of isolation from Walt Jr. or Flynn.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the end of it, like, and he cooks breakfast. He cooks so much breakfast, but everyone leaves before he can give it to him. And then he and Jesse are there at the end, and he's like, "Do you want breakfast?" And so, you know, it's that real, like...
Yeah, Jesse's lost his parents, Walt's lost his son, he's got all this excess breakfast, this metaphor, you know.
it's one of those things, like, they earn that end. And it's not a cliffhanger, but it's just a moment at the end which, like, really kind of just summarizes and just really kind of clarifies everything, and you're like,
Yeah, and the idea of Jesse being the surrogate son to Walt is something that they really are careful to be very subtle and state it rarely, because it's such an easy and obvious place to go to.
And it only really blatantly comes out once again. This is what happens, of course, with Walt, is that whenever he's on painkillers, he'll just blow something.
But, in this episode... like, you kind of get the first sense of that family. But before that, it's interesting, because before that, Walt parks the RV there, and Walt just furiously berates him, and he calls him an idiot, he's an asshole. He's a really big asshole. I have absolute sympathy with Jesse for just knocking him out and trying to strangle a man with cancer to death. But he calls Jesse Pinkman. Pinkman, which has this kind of... So he's very much in teacher mode. Like, he's very much, you know, you're a failure, Pinkman. And then, at the end, you know, he invites him inside the house and cooks him breakfast. So he's kind of gone from teacher to father.
And it's very interesting that, particularly mentioning that little change, because it comes back in the next episode. I feel this is a fair time to come on to Breakage, episode 5, which is a really important episode, directed by Johan Rank, who is considered one of the best directors of commercials in the world.
Right.
And hasn't done a great deal of narrative storytelling. So that's an interesting point I will come back to. But continuing on from the calling Jesse Pinkman and then later kind of offering him breakfast and everything, which is quite a pregnant little character moment there, you've got the fact that in this episode, of course, Jesse calls Walt for the first time.
Which is so... because he's still calling him Mr. White. In fact, I watched... All right, so the last scene of Jesse... All right, so for the season 5 extras, we'll actually talk about this in season 5 because it's relevant. There's an extra scene that was filmed which kind of shows what Jesse was doing in the last episode when we didn't see him. Anyway, the point is, he's talking to Saul, and this is at the very end of the series, you know, we've almost finished. He's still calling Walt Mr. White when talking to Saul. So, yeah, it's really... And to the show's credit, unlike the Heisenberg hat, which I think they kind of didn't think that one through and accidentally dropped it into the house when it shouldn't have been there, they make a big deal when he calls him Walt. It is used as this real, like, emphatic point that Jesse is kind of...
And it is a very strong moment, and you notice it, and you're like, whoa!
Yeah, and sort of... Jesse just saying, you know, we're not, you are not my boss, you're not my dad, where if you want to be a partner, then you cook and I'll sling.
Yeah.
And then we get...
And I want to touch, because I think I know what bit you're going to refer to, and I'd like to compare two sequences in this episode. There's the first one to my mind, and I'd like to kind of just keep in mind Johan Rankin but in this. Because, you know, with kind of limited kind of work with story and narrative, he can kind of use showy little sequences as a crutch. And there's that moment with Hank in the elevator where he kind of starts having some kind of seizure.
He has a panic attack.
And the way that's done is something that I kind of feel to be very in vogue at the moment. That kind of handheld, really kind of tied in on the face and the ambient kind of like, ooh.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And it really just, to be perfectly honest, I didn't feel like it was, almost didn't feel like it fit with Breaking Bad in a way, and it didn't jar with the series, but
I did feel like, yeah.
It kind of felt like a director kind of like doing his episode rather than serving the show and the style and kind of the moment, but like...
Nah, it wasn't just that, it just kind of felt a bit hacky.
Exactly, but the thing is, I feel that that kind of comes out of like, how do I effectively convey information in a short space of time, which is what a director like Johan Rankin is feeling. But the other side, the flip side of that coin, is that there is an incredible... awesome sequence of Skinny Pete, Combo, and Badger slinging in this episode, which is awesome. And when we were watching this one, and we were kind of just like noting, like, just like, watch this as an ad for a minute.
Yeah.
It's really, really, really
funny. Almost feels like a MasterCard ad or something.
It's like a really, down to the music. The music is the same. Whole just like, thing. Watch that sequence in episode 5. It feels like a dark MasterCard ad. Like Skinny Pete's like clicking his heels and everything, and they've got Jesse kind of. They've got the sped up motion, so he'll go be driving in his car, get Skinny Pete, meet him briefly, speed up, be Badger, and then speed up and then get Combo. So just collect the money from all of them. But really sped up, so it's only over like 5 seconds. So, well, you know,
the whole thing of like money changing hands and like, you know, the new product on the street does have that sense of an ad. Yeah, like, exactly. And it essentially is the in universe ad for Blue Crystal.
It's like, I wanna live in America.
Yeah, but like, I mean, we can't describe it, but if you watch that episode, just pay attention, it does really feel like some bizarre ad.
Down to just the percussion of the I just kind of noticed that. I was like, this it is the percussion. I swear it's just a tiny little touch. You're like, I swear to God, I've seen that in every MasterCard ad. So, you know,
in the music.
Yeah. So that's a really nice, like, comparing that sequence with the sequence of Hank in the elevator. So, you know, you've got two sides of the one coin of having a director who has that much experience with, say, music videos and commercials.
Yeah, but backing up a bit, because the other thing that's important in this episode is we meet Jane.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson. I still find that funny.
That's brilliant.
he gets his place, and then he actually sets up the operation. And it's just so fun, like, seeing him explain how it's going to go down to Skinny. And he gets his, he lays out the snacks for Badger, Skinny Pete and Combo.
Oh, yeah.
You know, says, no, you know, you smoke your shit on your own time. You know, he's trying to be all professional, but still are just these four guys. You assume kind of all went to high school together or something, yeah, yeah. You know, just fucking around. So
yeah, no,
yeah, it's quite hilarious, but there's an even better line in the seventh episode.
Oh yeah, we'll get to that. But just also quickly, the cold open of this episode, and it's another character developing point for Hank, is that the cold open is two random guys finding the grills that was given to Hank as a present. So the only way that you can assume anything happened is that he either got rid of it or it got lost. Yeah. So, you know, you kind of feel that...
Or that it was taken from him.
Well, yeah, but, like, just seeing the trajectory of Hank in this season, it feels more likely that he threw it away, which is...
What happens.
Which is what happens. And that's really just... It's a really interesting moment to kind of realise that that's really who he is, that the kind of facade that he puts up is that. It is this really kind of boyish, kind of boisterous facade, but deep down, he is, you know, he has panic attacks in elevators. You know?
And going back to what you said, that whole thing about him posing next to the dead body, which kind of at the time seemed really fucked up. You're like, you can now see, and particularly because they knew where they were going through the whole season, you know that scene there is kind of actually him covering for a natural reaction to seeing a dead body.
Yeah.
And, of course, he's about to be transferred to El Paso. Mm-hmm. And we get that kind of more forthright. But also what's really important about this episode is that Walt is talking about how he wants to be like Tuco. And he's referencing himself in comparison to Tuco, which is more important as when he deals with Gus. And I think we've kind of said this a few times, that when you sort of look about Walt in relation to Tuco, even though they're two very different characters, you kind of see a parallel between his relationship with Tuco and Gus, in that he's terrified of him. He kind of says outwardly he despises him, but in a way he wants to be more like him.
Mm. In terms of status and everything, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but even in terms of his ruthlessness, you know, he says that, you know, Tuco wouldn't stand for this shit. Yeah.
Absolutely, and that does kind of obviously come back in Peekaboo and a certain couple of other episodes. But just really quickly, one line that I think is as kind of important as any other, just in terms of somebody assessing Hank's character, who's known him for a long time and passing judgment on him, is when Murcutt says to him in this episode, he says, "Know why sharks are top of the food chain?" And Hank responds, and this... I think is a really important moment for Hank, is that this is how he almost wants to see himself, but Murcutt kind of comes back at him with the way that he actually is. What Hank responds with is, because they have three sets of teeth and take a bite out of everything, which is kind of the way that he kind of wants to be perceived in a way. But then Murcutt comes back with, no, that some of those suckers travel hundreds of miles in pursuit of their prey. And you're just like, that's...
Which is what's brilliant about that is, because of course you think, El Paso, right, cool. That's nice. But it also sums up the massive long game that Hank is going to get involved with in terms of finding Heisenberg and finding the Gus Fring organization and eventually coming to Walt, which fucking we're a long way away from. Yeah, but
exactly, we're hundreds of miles away from that side of catching that prey. But that's the thing, is that, you know, this is like where he kind of comes to realize that, you know, his persona as a police officer and his role, like, is not so much about the way he kind of appears to be doing it, but he really kind of gets down to actually doing it.
Yeah,
way, which
is really
important.
And as the series goes on, he becomes, you know, a fantastic detective, essentially.
Absolutely. So, you know, but yeah, leading from that into...
Well, actually, just one more thing, because at the end, we just need to point out that Skinny Pete gets held up by Spooge and Skank.
Yes.
And Walt
at
the end of the slinging sequence, insists that Jesse sort it out. And Walt's talking about breakage. No, Jesse's talking about breakage. And Walt, you know, says that this is completely unacceptable, and that they need to be more like Tuco. Which is already... And I think this is the first kind of real hint we get of how ruthless Walt wants to be, even if he's not quite actually at that point yet. Like, he's not at the point yet where he will do what Jesse's going to do. He still needs to send Jesse out. He still needs that sense of removal. But it's moving towards the kind of ruthlessness that we see in particularly season 5.
Yeah.
But yeah, so... Peekaboo.
To Spurgeon's, Spurgeon's Gang.
Which is, I think, one of the best episodes that the series has done.
Series or season?
Series. One of. It's in the top 10. I'll tell you why. So, first of all, it's a great... Your first impression of this episode is a great bottle episode. It's a great standalone episode. This whole misadventure with Jesse in the house is incredibly... It's just a self-contained, great kind of combination of suspense, horror, comedy, pathos with the kid. It's just really well done. And then you kind of... What I forgot about this episode was this contains the exchange between Walt and Jesse where he tells her, fuck you.
Tells her? Walt and Jesse?
Walt and Gretchen.
Right, yes.
Where Gretchen comes back and he says, fuck you. And the thing is that looking back at this, this is such an important episode because it sets up two key traits that will define both of them until the series. That is that Jesse draws the line with kids, and this is key to the end of season 3. It's key to the end of season 4, and it's key to the end of season 5A. So Jesse's relationship with kids defines the plot of each season in a really big way with, you know, just that random kid that gets shot in season 3 with Brock and with the kid that...
that random kid that gets shot in season 5.
What's his face? Todd shoots after the train heist. And on the flip side of that, we understand that Walt, in his dealing with Gretchen, has a lot of issues built up about how he was forced out of the business of Grey Matter. And we don't know how. We still don't know all the details. We kind of get that he left, but he feels like he was forced to leave and that it was all very inequitable and they've built a legacy off his back. And, of course, you know that this is feeding into him in his kind of dogged pursuit of building a meth empire. And then in season 5, he just outright says, look, I had a chance to make a name for myself and I blew it. Not going to happen again.
Mm.
Heisenberg for the win.
Yeah.
And this is beautifully summed up with, I love whenever they have Walt in the classroom kind of providing some kind of
context and detail. Yeah. And kind of just like colouring, like adding different shades to what obviously will come later.
Yeah. So he's talking about H. Tracy Hall, who I believe invented plastic or something, or carbon dye. Oh no, he synthesized diamonds.
Something like, yes,
yeah,
that's the one.
Yeah, he synthesized diamonds. And he's talking about how a carbon made man made carbon and printed on carbon paper.
Point was, he came up with something good.
And it was stolen from him. And H. Tracy Hall is kind of...
And he got nothing for it.
He got nothing for it. And H. Tracy Hall is obviously... Walt identifies with him as the scientist who was screwed over. And he kind
by a corporate entity.
By a corporate entity. And he doesn't want to make that mistake again. Yeah. And in a way, if you think about it, you know, this is actually affects... Because, you know, he kind of... When he goes to work for Gus... There's this whole thing about how he's making so much money, yet he feels like he should be getting more because he is creating the product.
Mm.
And this sort of explains why, and why he feels so entitled to a share of the profits, like a reputation, power.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It is a very key detail, the H. Tracy Hall. Like, we only really noticed it kind of going back the second time. Mm. We were just watching it and we were like, boom.
That explains a lot.
Yes, right there. There is, you know, there's Walter White. So, you know.
And I think, this episode in general, it's kind of, you remember it as a Jesse episode, but there's some really important stuff with Walt. But the Jesse stuff, I mean...
The Jesse stuff is pretty incredible. Like, it is like a certain... I think Breaking Bad is one thing... There are many things Breaking Bad does well, but one thing it really, really nails when it goes at it is stuff that happens in or close to real time.
Yeah,
and
right.
With this episode, like, you've got a really kind of immediate situation for which the consequences are apparent and real, and it just feels like that the whole time, and there is a natural tension in that.
Mm.
And this episode is also directed by Peter Medak, who's
quite older.
Yeah, apparently he's Hungarian, I think.
Yeah.
And apparently there was this, I was listening to the behind the scenes on it, and apparently he'd always be like, okay, darling, now, darling, could you please stop crying in this moment, darling. Come on, darlings, now. We need to get Skank and Spooge into position, darlings. He called everyone darling, which I just...
And that's the funny, like, he's just this old guy, like, so naturally, like, it's a bit more kind of classical. I noticed with this episode, the handheld is a lot steadier than in any other episode that I can think of. David Stratton would be stoked with this episode, I reckon. So, you know, it's really nicely directed. The one thing... I think the cold open is probably just about the worst cold open in the show, because it's just like, it's just, I don't know, it's not really directed like a cold open. It's kind of just directed like a scene. Like,
No, that's not true. You get some nice bits.
There are some cross cuts, but nothing really.
Well, sure, but there's the nice thing with Jesse and the bug.
Yeah, well, yeah, so what, he doesn't kill the bug, but like that's...
He makes all this effort to kind of save the bug, and then Badger just... Skinny Pete just squashes it.
Yeah.
But also another thing about this episode is it's a great example of sort of Breaking Bad using the horrors or just kind of the really disgusting elements of the drug trade, I guess. Or just kind of these sort of prosaic issues and turning them into something sort of supernaturally horrible.
Yeah.
Which is Skank and Spooge in their house. It does feel like they're monsters in a haunted mansion or something. Like, they are truly terrifying.
Yeah.
They're like zombies.
Yeah, it's like a haunted house kind of thing that, like, you know, you'd see when you're, like, 8 or something, and it'd scare the bejesus out of you. And, of course, you got the 8-year-old kid in that environment.
Yeah, and apparently they had to make really sure that he wasn't too freaked out.
Well, they were played by twins.
That they weren't too freaked out by Skank and Spooge.
One other thing that is really interesting before we get to the kid, just quickly to kind of like, I just want to talk about that briefly, but again with the victimless crime idea of like kind of like that is the center of the whole show in a way, but like the really nice, there's it's Spooge talking to Jesse about how they stole the ATM.
Yeah.
Like, victimless crime, man, but it's undercut with like the images of the crime scene left, and they're like, he's just talking about this victimless crime. And there's just, like, some poor shopping attendant who actually looks a lot like Hugo.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, like, not quite. Like, it isn't Hugo, but, like it's kind of in your head.
It's another person who got completely screwed over,
but he's dead. He's just lying there in a pool of his own blood, just murdered. So you're just like, oh, yeah, victimless crime, yeah.
Yeah.
Gotta love it.
And clearly this whole thing just fucks Jesse up so much as we see next episode.
Yeah. When he says, like, I can't get the sound out of my ears, just quickly also, first mention of the GFC in this episode.
Yeah.
And also the whole peekaboo aspect of it, just quite simply, like, close your eyes, keep your eyes closed to the horror. Like,
yeah.
Let's look at this. Let's keep ourselves innocent almost in a way, just for the kid, kind of keep that.
Yeah. And I think that's a nice little kind of all-encompassing metaphor for the show, but
it kind of asks an interesting question, because that is the trait that they all kind of have, is that they all manage to keep their eyes closed to the horror, but that's kind of what makes them so evil. But to, you know, keep innocence, you kind of need to keep your eyes closed.
But that also is sort of what defines when we're introduced to Gus and Mike, two people who kind of have a similar relationship, but they keep their eyes open. At first we think they're psychopaths, but as it sort of develops, you get the sense that actually they're kind of more well balanced and honest than Walt is. No, I don't think Gus is kind of...
We kind of ran into this last podcast. Like, again, I'm not going to have coffee with Gus Fring.
Sure. Look, we'll get... I mean, I'd have dinner with him. He looks like he cooks a good dinner. He
does, but it's still...
We'll talk about I'm Gus sure when he's introduced. I'm sure we might
mention him in season 4.
Yes. We shouldn't talk about Gus now.
There's plenty of time to talk about Gus.
Yes, there is plenty of time.
So let's move right along, shall we?
To Negro y Azul.
Right on.
Which means black and blue, and that is the name of the Nacarido. I think it's Nacarido.
Nacarido, yeah. So this is tell us what a
Well, a Nacarido is, I'm just gonna check and make sure that's the right word. It means drug ballad. And that video at the start is basically
the cold open, one of the better cold opens.
Yeah. So Nacarido is a Mexican subgenre of music, and it literally means drug ballad, and they're just these songs that, Nacarido, that's right. that's basically just about the exploits of gangsters as these sort of, and like, modern day ones. So, like, it is feasible that a song about Heisenberg would exist, but they're sort of these mythical creations as opposed to the real deal. And I mean, what's so clever about this is it's kind of, you know, getting the exposition that the blue stuff is making its way across the border, that Heisenberg is gaining a rep, and that the cartel are interested. It's a great way of kind of putting all this exposition and just sort of making you subtly aware that there's something bigger going on here without having, you know, a cut to a boss in a room going, Señor!
Yeah.
The blue stuff is back.
And it's also...
Heisenberg is on the streets, but instead we get this really daggy music video that will just leave you going, what the fuck?
And see, the thing is, the first time I saw it, I didn't have subtitles for it, so I couldn't see what the lyrics were. So I was just like, oh, okay, so they're just having a big old laugh at me. I'm happy for that to happen because this is really funny. So great. But the thing is that, like, seeing it with, you can pretty much pick most of it up. Because, like, you see, like, the map of, like, New Mexico, and then it moves down, like, Mexico. So you see, like,
it's really didactic. Yeah.
It's pretty simple. Like, it's pretty, like, you know, I'm reasonably visually literate. I understand what's going on. But the thing is, the one thing that I kind of notice in watching the, it with the words.
Yeah.
There's a bit where it kind of, like, focuses on Heisenberg. Well, it's not actually him, like...
But, yeah, a guy who...
But a guy who's got who's the standing pork pie in hat.
Because they don't really know what Heisenberg looks like. They only know what he looks like...
The pork pie hat. Kind of,
Yeah, exactly.
Just from what hearsay tells him. But the lyric is, that homie's dead, he just don't know it yet. Which I found to be very interesting, because it almost feels like... Well, is that foreshadowing, or is that just what the cartel thinks that they are going to do to him?
Well,
like,
I think...
What is that? What like, it's such an odd thing to kind of see, having seen the rest of it.
Yeah, and I think the whole point of that is really, it pushes us into kind of act two, if you want, of the series overall, which is the cartel. And the cartel becomes such a big part of the series, and it's basically suggesting in a really...
Well, just the presence of another drug entity.
Walt is bitten off more than he can chew, because in this whole episode he's going on about how he wants to take territory, and you think that the bad guys are going to be people like Crazy A and Tuco, when really you've got people like Don Eladio.
And that's the thing, is that It doesn't really feel like, it doesn't necessarily feel like it's a reality until Combo gets shot, and then for me, like, that was when I realized that, like, the show had kicked into gear, and there was not a bad moment from then on.
Yeah, I mean, it does just escalate from there.
Not to say that ABQ, that's not casting any, like, you know, any aspersion
but,
on anything.
Yeah,
but,
let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, so this whole episode really is just about kind of hinting at bigger things at play, because the B plot is Hank going to El Paso.
Yeah, and where being really, like just a racist kind of asshole.
Yeah, I know. He's just like... He makes such an ass of himself, but it saves him in the end.
Yeah, but it is very interesting, though. There's a moment here where he's, like, talking about the Mexican cartel drug icon, whatever it is that the guy has on his desk. And he turns around and he says, if you know... Sun Tzu, he's like, Sun, what? If you know your enemy as yourself, you'll fight without fear in many battles. And I was just like, if you know your enemy as yourself, like, obviously for Hank,
Hank and Walt.
That's such a really...
It's a nice little...
You'll fight without fear, though. Like, no.
Hank, if you know Hank, your Hank enemy, looks like he's got a bit of fear at the end when he's on that toilet.
Exactly. If you know your enemy as yourself, then you just, like, that's just a really interesting sentence to kind of consider with the context and everything leading up to that moment. There's so much more fear. So it's a really interesting little moment.
But we really see how much the cartel are playing for keeps, of course, where they get Danny Trejo's head, put it on a turtle, and then blow the shit out of it. Which, so I didn't know that was going to happen when I watched it, and I don't think this episode should be watched by people with heart disorders, because I think I literally screamed. Also, you know, I had it on a big TV, I had the good sound turned up. I think I literally just screamed, oh shit, at the TV when I was by myself when that turtle blew up. And
see, yeah. I did know it was coming. Somebody blew it for me. And I was just like, I really wish I knew what it was like to not know that was coming.
Yeah, it's
but
fucked.
I did.
Yeah, it's not pleasant, man.
Don't worry. I was not under any misconceptions that it was pleasant. I know it's not pleasant. But, you know, it's kind of just another thing altogether to kind of... know where it's going. I was kind of, like, dreading it.
Yeah, I think that whole scene with the cartel and the turtle on the head, that whole sequence is really nightmarish from when you first realize, when you first see the head sort of moving around, and that's creepy in its own right, then you see it's on a turtle, and that's just wrong. Then it explodes, and then people have lost their legs, and the sound drops out. And, you know, talking about how, you know, you use those cliched ways of sort of showing distress and dropping the sound out. I mean, in episode 5, yeah, I think you're right, that is kind of hacky, but in this episode, it works perfectly, because that's exactly the sort of state you are in as the audience, because you're overwhelmed by the explosion.
And that's the thing, because this episode was actually directed by Felix Alcala, who actually directed a fair few episodes of Breaking Bad. So the difference is, Johan Renck, I think, directed, like, maybe one or two, but, you know, Felix Enriquez Alcala directed a fair few, so he kind of actually, he was kind of a bit more of a presence. So, you know, I think, you know, like, when you kind of got that kind of cohesive tone and everything going on, like as this, I feel this episode is really strong in that respect.
Yeah, I do. It's a better episode than I remember. And also you get the idea of Walt. I mean, we touched upon it in episode 6, but it's the first sign of him really wanting to build an empire. And he, you know, with exponential growth, like nachos.
Just kind of making connections, which is, that's the thing. Like, he was talking, again, at the beginning of the episode, he's talking about connections and bonds.
Yeah.
He's talking about just, like, getting a network of just all these when points all connected.
To the and he's saying, in the classroom.
Like, connections is what makes matter matter.
Yeah.
He's just like, oh, that's a hilarious little, you know. Like, again, just with, like...
Using the classroom as a little bit of thematic exposition.
He's just talking to one kid, and then the way that he doesn't take his bullshit, don't bullshit a bullshitter.
Yeah, that's...
It's, again, just a character moment. But also, just, you know, I love that. I love that when story, theme, and character just interweave, and you just can't tell which yeah, like, if a scene is you know, is, like, prioritized, you're just like, good.
Yeah.
This is, you know, this is...
It's solid writing all around. Professional, yeah.
So, you know, but, like, and that's with Hank, like when he has some kind of reaction to the Tortuga situation, so he leaves and it saves his life.
Yeah, which feels perfectly in character.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Like you it's all been set up so that, you know, he's not as tough as he looks, that he would leave in this situation, that he's not ready for El Paso, but it also saves a main character.
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree. That's brilliant writing and what could be really contrived. It's the same way that he, you know, manages to avoid discovering Walt in the desert. You know, discovering Walt with Tuco. Breaking Bad is really good at avoiding having Hank finding out without it ever being contrived. Unlike Dexter, which is terrible at that, which is kind of the flip side of how to tell that sort of story. But the other thing is we get Heisenberg appearing to Badger and Skinny Pete.
In the science museum with the nuclear bomb
which
photo
is,
and the duck and cover propaganda tune playing, which is a lovely little...
Yeah, that's, Timmy the Turtle or something. We studied this in school. Yeah.
No, Turtle, and his name was Bert.
Yeah.
Bert the Turtle, he never got hurt.
Bert the Turtle, who never got hurt. That's just a nice touch. I love Cold War era propaganda. But it's also great the way that in this scene he's sort of indifferent and he's kind of confused about what they're talking about. But the way he plays it, you can see how, from a certain perspective, that can be seen as being really intimidating.
Mm.
So in the right context, everything that makes Walt...
You can see the wheels turning, but which wheels? What's he thinking?
Yeah, what makes Walt often so pathetic can also make him really intimidating in the right setting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love just the way he ends that. After saying pretty much nothing and not giving anything away, he says, they're saying, like, so is it true, man? Did Jesse Stump really do it? Did he really do it? Did he kill, what's his name,
Spooge?
And he says... What he says, and this is perfectly, again, in character, perfectly thematic and great for story, he says, you didn't hear it from me.
Yeah.
So he remains the unseen partner. He doesn't, you know...
Yeah, but he uses it to forward Jesse, and then he goes to Jesse and gives him the whole blowfish speech.
Oh, having seen the blooper reel from that scene as well, just kind of seeing that they just struggle with that, you can, like, it's great watching it again, because you're just like, that's hilarious.
Yeah, and then, he's talking about exponential growth, and then when Jesse's pitching it to the partner, he goes, all right, we're going to have layers, like nachos, exponential growth.
Like, brilliant. And that oh.
Yeah, and then of course it ends with Jesse and Jane getting close for the first time,
holding hands. When the television is not coming on, so you know it's also a little message there. Don't watch television, kids. Go on.
And I think this is why it's a good place to end here, because we've got the cartel have been introduced in a very kind of sort of in the background way, which is good because then they wouldn't be quite as threatening. We've got Jesse starting his relationship with Jane, Walt becoming less of a silent partner, the business starting to grow.
While still trying to remain, he's getting involved, but he's remaining unseen in a way.
We've pulled Hank out of El Paso. The whole thing is it's shifting into high gear. Mm. And the reason I'm glad we did 7 episodes instead of 6, because there's so much stuff that's going to happen in those final 6 episodes. I mean, season 2 is very slow.
Mm.
I think overall it's very slow.
I like it.
Yeah, no, I like it. I think that's why it's really good. And compare it to season 3, which I think kind of has a first act that has its climax and then its second act, which has its climax. This is all one build up to the end, which I prefer. So this first stretch of episodes is all very much a big build, and it's all continuing and it's kind of building up each week.
Mm.
So there's not a lot of big shit going down in these episodes that we've just talked about, which I think works overall in the series, in this season's favour, and it kind of shows that they planned it all out from the beginning, as opposed to season 3, which is sort of more fly by the seat of your pants, for better or worse.
So I think, can we do just a very, very brief progress report on Best Cold Open?
Yeah, alright, we can have our quick Breaking Bad awards. So I mean,
Best Cold Open so far from the first 7, I reckon Jesse's Lowrider.
Okay, well, I mean, for diversity's sake, I'll go for Negro Azul. Yeah, but they're both pretty awesome. Yeah, Negro Azul.
And then best moment is probably Tortuga.
I think Tortuga's head blowing up is pretty shocking on many levels. The best episode, I think, for me is undoubtedly Peekaboo.
Yeah, I'd say I probably agree. I mean, just in terms of something that stands alone, it's pretty incredible.
But also, I mean, yeah, for something that stands alone, but also for something that just sets up so many important character things. As a character study, it's really important. You know, I think it's actually more important, say, than something like Fly, in terms of how it just defines the relationships in the series.
Yeah.
And also, funniest moment, I think it's got to go
to Steely Dan waffle.
I do like...
Okay, well, wait, what's yours?
Right, layers.
Yeah.
Like nachos.
Yeah.
They're both pretty good. Yeah, we don't have anything like the robbery.
No.
Yeah. But anyway, that's the first part of season 2. Join us next.
Well, let's go and watch a couple episodes.
Yes, we'll see where we go. Thanks for listening.
Have a good one.
Hang on. If you want to email us, you can email us at cavaliersdocinema@gmail.com. And go to our blog, cavaliersdocinema.blogspot.com, or cavaliersdotelevision.blogspot.com, or cavaliersdo all things.
We are up in this internet presence.
Yeah, bitch. Anyway, thanks for listening, and
have a good one.
Have a good one.